Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. On Tuesday, a San Marcos police officer was arrested by his own department for aggravated assault, according to the San Marcos Police Department, after allegedly illegally assaulting and attempting to detain a bystander to one of his traffic stops back in May. Corporal James Palomero was placed on administrative leave as a result of the May 29th incident, wherein it is claimed that he slammed a woman onto the pavement, causing her to lose two of her teeth after she didn't stop upon his request. Do police officers think that they are occupiers in a hostile land? More and more police officers are being taught to be soldiers, argues Radley Balco. He's the investigative journalist and a policy analyst for the Cato Institute, and he has a new book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop. Balco joins us on the show to talk about the new book and what changes need to be made. Radley, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me on.
And the number to call if you want to jump in the conversation, if you think police officers are getting too rowdy with their authority, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. So, Rad, let me ask you, are police officers in the force, are they being told that they are having to prepare to, are they in a war against the public?
Well, for about a generation now, we've been telling police officers that they're at war. We've got the war on drugs. They're being told they're fighting a war on crime. Since September 11th, there's the war on terrorism. And when you combine that, you know, this incessant sort of martial rhetoric from politicians with the fact that police officers are increasingly armed like soldiers, the Pentagon has been giving away surplus military equipment for about 30 years now to police agencies across the country, armored personnel carriers, tanks, M16s, bayonets, helicopters. So then you combine all that with the rise in the use of SWAT teams. There's been about a 1,500% increase in the number of SWAT team callouts since the early 1980s. So if you tell police officers they're fighting a war and you arm them like soldiers, and you train them in military tactics and in military-like uniforms, at some point, you know, that's going to have an effect on how they approach their jobs.
In America, don't we have a tradition of the military not patrolling the streets?
We do, and it's a healthy tradition. The military and police have two very different missions. The military's job is to annihilate a foreign enemy, to kill people and break things, basically. Police officers' job is to keep the peace, to protect our rights, to protect and serve. And these are two very, very different missions, and it's dangerous to conflate them. And, you know, for most of our history, we've done a good job of keeping the military out of domestic policing. We don't have soldiers, you know, searching houses or patrolling streets or doing making arrests. So what I argue in the book, though, is that we've undergone what you might call indirect police militarization, which is, you know, it's not that our soldiers are acting as cops, it's that our cops are increasingly taking on a lot of the characteristics of soldiers.
One image that keeps coming to mind as we talk about this is the police officer who was spraying kids during the Occupy movement, and with the pepper spray right in their face, and just sort of walking down the line, these kids who were sitting on the ground peacefully. And it seems like that is the battle line that's being formed between maybe organizers against corporate power and structure and the big banks, and as people try to organize to combat that, or at least raise their concerns, that this is the police that's being brought out to contain those folks.
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of different things going on here. First, you have this explosion in the number and frequency of use of SWAT teams, which they're being used now to, you know, since early 1980s, they've been used, ubiquitously to serve warrants on people suspected of drug crimes. But, you know, we've recently seen them being used to break up, you know, neighborhood poker games, in some cases even enforce regulatory law. There have been SWAT teams sent to bars where there's suspected underage drinking going on. So this is a violent, heavy, the highest level of force basically that a local police department can use, and they're using it for increasingly petty crimes. But the other thing we're seeing, which is what you were just getting into a little bit, is the response to protests. And this started in 1999 and during the WTO protests in Seattle, where the police response was extremely heavy-handed. In fact, the police chief, Seattle police chief at the time, Norm Stamper, has since said that the way he responded to those protests, he now calls it the biggest mistake of his career, because he's seen how police and police departments in cities have responded to protests since then, that this has become sort of the default way that you handle protests is by sending cops out in full riot gear, sort of expecting confrontation. And when you send, police officers out expecting confrontation, it creates a lot of animosity between them and the protesters, right off the bat.
So usually the reaction that people would say, well, let's videotape the police. Everyone, pull out your cell phones. But we do see people being arrested or sometimes harassed by police if they try to videotape them. And is videotaping the police a crime?
No, and I think it's important to get this out. It is not a crime in any of the 50 states. It can't be a crime. It's been the last state that tried to make it a crime, Illinois. It was struck down by a federal court of that law was struck down by a federal court of appeals. So it is always legal to record on-duty police officers as long as you're not physically interfering with what they're doing. Now they can arrest you anyway. They can make up a reason why they're arresting you. They can say you're interfering, even if you're not. They can, they could cite you for something like disorderly conduct, which, or some similarly vague charge. But the charge won't stick. I mean, it can inconvenience you for a while.
Well, that's quite an inconvenience to spend a night in jail away from your family, maybe do damage to your standing in the community and lose your job.
Well, yeah, it would. And if you are illegally arrested, you have the option of filing a lawsuit. Now, the problem is to sue a police officer, you have to show that they intentionally violated your rights and that the rights that were violated are well established. And, right now, people aren't sure about this, about whether or not it's legal to record police. So that's why, the more the word gets out that it is perfectly legal, the more established those rights become, and the easier it is then to hold police officers who do make illegal arrests. It makes it easier to hold them accountable. It would be good for legislatures to step up and say, this is legal, this should be protected. The Obama administration, in fact, the Department of Justice has on a couple of occasions now come out and publicly stated that recording on-duty police officers is protected by the First Amendment. So I think it's important to get that out there, and particularly if you're seeing, obvious police abuse going on. Now, you want to protect yourself. If the officer looks violent and, may come after you, you might want to weigh your priorities, I guess. But I do think it's important to get the word out that it is always legal to record on-duty police officers.
We're going to take a quick break, come back for phone calls. The number is 614-8980 to serve and protect. There are a lot of great police officers out there. They are being told sometimes that they are at war, and sometimes the public is the enemy. We want to talk about that and hear your stories. Give us a call, 614-8980. This is The Source. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about the book Rise of the Warrior Cop, Militarization of America's Police Force. The author is Radley Balko. He argues that police in the United States are being told that they are at war, and frequently the enemy can be the American public, and they are being armed and they're being given body armor and they're being given tactical training on how to contain folks who sometimes are just trying to stand up for our rights. Is that a good assessment, Mr. Balko, about what you wrote?
Sure. And, I want to reemphasize the point you made before we took a break, which is that there are good police officers out there. And my book is not it's not an anti-cop book. It's more of an anti-politician book. It's really the elected officials who have set these policies that have set this trend in motion. And, you know, if you have a bad system loaded with bad incentives, you're going to get bad results no matter, you know, what kind of people are in that system. So I really think, you know, none of this is really going to change until politicians want it to change. And for them to want it to change, voters have to want it to change.
The number to call to join the conversation, 614-8980. Let's go to the phones. Let's go with Brendan. He wants to welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you for having me on today. Appreciate it. So one of the points that I think that we should definitely bring up when we're discussing this topic, we're talking about the militarization of civilian police, I mean, of local police departments. What's going on in Salt Lake City right now? What's going on with the UPD that's happening up there? Why are we supplying so many cops with hollow point ammunition? Why did the Obama administration just purchase 1.6 billion rounds of sniper and hollow point ammunition for training exercises? And why are we training them using cutouts of children and cutouts of pregnant women? I don't think that there's many pregnant women that are up in revolt and up in arms causing disorderly conduct that should result in being shot at, as far as all the articles I've been reading recently.
So you're saying that the police are being trained. Give me a little more background here, Brendan. Where are you going?
I am trying to find the article right now. I actually had to pull over on the highway to look at this. But there's been articles recently explaining that some of the militarized police departments, as we're referring to them today, are receiving cutouts of children and shooting targets of children and pregnant women.
Okay,
yeah, I know the article, but
go ahead, Mr. Bockel.
Yeah, I know the article he's talking about, and there were some police departments that had these cutouts, and the idea was to that, you know, anyone can be a threat, and that the police officers need to learn to be able to, they need to sort of get over their revulsion at shooting at, you know, something like pregnant women or children or elderly people, because, you know, they can be a threat as well. There's some publicity, bad publicity, as you might imagine, when it came out. And I understand that the company that makes those has discontinued them, and the police departments aren't using them anymore. But yeah, it was a pretty disturbing story when it came out.
And about the point about buying all the ammunition, I have had a chance to ask State Representative Lamar Smith about that, and he didn't see anything wrong with that. He says that it's common practice for the government to buy ammunition in big lots like that in order to save money. But that's been that's become a story on its own, and people have tried to read into that. So let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Joe. Joe, welcome to The Source.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
It's no problem. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, you know, I'm in a good way. I'm absolutely shocked that I'm listening to this discussion on the radio. If this were mainstream, it would have been shut down half an hour ago. I like the fact that you're talking about things that are really happening in a way that people can understand, and that, you know, the book and your guests are not anti-cop. I have family members who are in the police force, but that nonetheless, them being told through local policy that they have to do these things, and these things are what's right, without, you know, regard to the Constitution or whatever it may be, that they're put in a predicament. But nonetheless, even if they're caught up in the middle, some of the things we're seeing are violent and an overreaction. So, you know, I didn't really have a comment or question specifically. I just thank you for writing the book. Thank you for having the guest. And, you know, there are real concerned people out there about things that are happening that aren't complete nut jobs. And I'm just glad you all are representing that viewpoint very well.
Well, thanks, Joe. Thank you for your comments. And, you know, I got family also who's in law enforcement. You know, I was talking to a person in law enforcement, and he was working for a small town police force. And they had like a meeting where someone came in and told him about how their little town, even though it was in the middle of nowhere, Texas, could be a target by Al-Qaeda and international terrorists, and they should always be ready. And they really hyped him up about the possibility that this little place, and, you know, very hard to find, would be someplace that the international terrorists would target. And I'm wondering, is that something that that they do to kind of make police officers who have the best intentions in order to want to protect their public and their citizens, but they also sometimes get so exuberant in doing their jobs that sometimes they go a little too far?
Yeah, I mean, I think the terrorism threat is overblown, and particularly in some of these smaller towns. The Department of Homeland Security has been giving out anti-terror grants basically since September 11th. They've given out about $35 billion in grants, and these police departments are using them to buy, you know, things like high-powered weapons, armored personnel carriers, tanks, that sort of thing. And then, you know, once you have this equipment, you know, your average town, and we're talking about places like, you know, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, are getting this stuff. You know, once you have it, and there is no terrorist attack, you want to use it. And so then it becomes part of more routine policing and, you know, use on drug raids and, you know, more kind of conventional policing that has nothing to do with terrorism. And that, I think, is a big part of the problem. The other thing is that these grants, there have been companies that have sprung up now just to build the equipment to fulfill these grants. And, you know, these companies then have money to open lobbying shops in Washington to make sure that the money keeps flowing. And we've basically, I mean, since September 11th especially, I think we've created what you might call a police industrial complex, kind of the younger brother of the military industrial complex. And once you get that, it becomes really difficult, you know, to start to try to rein this stuff in.
So there should be some sort of cost risk analysis for what we're spending for turning our police forces into military forces to protect us from a threat that may or may not be there.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And part of the problem is there just isn't much data. You know, police departments don't really keep track of this. The ACLU has started a campaign to try to find out just how you know, saturated police militarization has become across the country.
Okay.
I'm going
to another caller, and Bradley is on the phone. Bradley, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say thanks for reporting on this. This is one of the reasons I listen to you guys, and I'm going to give you money when I can. This kind of reporting really needs to be done. Very important.
Well, thank you.
But, my comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my comment was that growing up, I grew up next to the chief of police in my town, and I used to want to be a cop myself and join the military and all that. But growing up after high school, I was arrested for marijuana and mushrooms. And after that whole experience, it just really kind of shattered my kind of trust in the police.
Okay. So were you like, you know, I mean, if you have marijuana, if you have mushrooms, you're breaking the law. You should be arrested, right?
Yeah, but the whole process of going through it and being treated like a criminal, you know, like I was treated like a dangerous person.
Well, you were a criminal.
I am a criminal. I absolutely am. And but after just seeing
But were you a dangerous criminal?
But
I think they added the thing is the modifier, dangerous criminal. Were you a dangerous criminal?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was just a young kid. I used to want to be a cop myself. I really look up to the opportunity to be able to really protect, you know, kind of fellow people and whatnot, but just the way that the whole thing was handled, kind of treating me like and throwing me in a cage, nonetheless, with dangerous criminals. After the whole thing, I kind of had a nervousness around police officers.
Well, you bring up an interesting point.
I'm not breaking the law.
I want to try and get to our guest. So, thank you for your Bradley. Thank you for those comments. I'm going to try. So, he brings up the war on drugs, which, you know, has armed the police force, put America on a military footing, dealing with their own public, and put so many people in prison and into the court system because of recreational use of marijuana and things like that. Was that intentional?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the war on drugs is called the war on drugs for a reason, and it's because the politicians want a military-like response to, you know, eradicate drug use. And, I mean, the war on drugs has really driven police militarization. I mean, I talked about September 11th, but, you know, the war on drugs has been militarizing the police since the early 1980s with the Reagan administration. I mean, they brought the National Guard in to start enforcing the drug laws. Reagan and some congressional leaders actually wanted to even bring in active duty troops to patrol streets and conduct searches and make arrests. Fortunately, that was one of the few bad ideas that did not get through, but the National Guard certainly, and then this you know, militarizing of the everyday cop as well. It's also about proportional use of force. I mean, the previous caller talked about being arrested for marijuana. You know, the vast majority of SWAT raids today, and there are about 100 to 150 SWAT raids each day in this country. The vast majority of those are on people suspected of marijuana crimes, of violating the marijuana laws. And, you know, these people aren't dangerous. These are consensual crimes. And not only are they nonviolent and consensual crimes, but, you know, these people are still only suspected of violating those laws. It used to be that you reserved SWAT teams and that sort of, you know, violent confrontational government force for emergency situations where you had someone who presented an immediate threat to the public. So, you know, hostage takings and bank robberies and active shooters. And there, you know, somebody's already established that they're dangerous, they're an immediate threat, so using violence to diffuse an already violent situation.
Right, so Radley Balco, the author of The Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Force. Thanks for joining us here on The Source today. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
The Source is a production of Texas Public Radio. Paul Flav produces the show. Oversight is provided by TPR Program Director Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor, and production assistance comes from Catherine Dixon. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.